KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT Houston at 90.1 FM HD2, Houston's community media station. We discuss local, state, national, and international stories and analyze them that may have slipped under your radar. My co-host, editor, assistant producer, and really constant counterfoil is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
All right, time for election nags. So November 7th is the general election. I'm not going to overwhelm you with stuff. There's really right now only one date you need to know, maybe two. Any voting registration or any change like a living address to your voter registration must be done by October 10th, the end of business of October 10th. Seems like a long time away. Yeah, not so much. 7 weeks. More or less. So it's like, do it while it's convenient. Don't wait until you have to, like, get the mail post-dated. Also, if you want to get a mail-in ballot, the last time to apply for that is for that filled-out paper request for a ballot to be at the clerk's office no later than the end of business Friday the 27th. So again, don't dilly-dally. I've got links. Push comes to shove. If HarrisVotes.com doesn't seem to give you the information you need, if you live outside of Harris County, if you don't have access immediately easily to your county voting clerk, just go to VoteTexas.gov, and the Secretary of State, and even as a Republican, will still help you with all that stuff. Okay, so our first story is from CommunityImpact.com. Tomball enters stage 2 drought, mandatory water restrictions in place. The city of Tomball in Harris County has entered a stage 2 drought with mandatory water conservation measures in place for residents, according to an August 8th news release. In a nutshell, a stage 2 drought is triggered when total daily demand exceeds 70% of the city's production capacity for 3 consecutive days, and that's according to the city's water conservation and drought contingency plan. This is an escalation of the stage 1 drought, which the city entered into on July 19th, according to a previous report from Community Impact. The specifics, according to the news release, under a stage 2 drought, watering with irrigation systems or hose end sprinklers is prohibited between 5 a.m. and 7 p.m. Also, odd addresses are restricted to watering on Wednesday. Even-numbered addresses, watering on Thursday. So I'm hoping whatever it is you're watering can live for a whole week without being watered. Also, washing vehicles and filling swimming pools is prohibited between 5 a.m. and 7 p.m. This is obviously because those are the periods of highest demand. The use of water fountains for ponds that do not support aquatic life is prohibited. Empty those fountains. Watering with a bucket or a watering can is permitted at any time. So if you have potted plants, or you have a number of perhaps planted in the soil plants, if you're willing to go around with a hand watering can or a bucket, apparently you are free to do so. Residents can learn more about the stage 2 drought and keep up with the city's drought status by visiting, and then there is a link, which it's probably easier to go to thinkwingradio.com to just, you know, look at it, because it's item 4, and it'll be item 4. Well, it'll be item 4 or 5 by the time it's posted. But it'll be right above Andrew's comments, so that should be easy to find.
Yeah, you can just go to tomballtx.gov, and it'll probably be somewhere there as well.
Yeah, it'll get you there. Okay, Andrew, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, this story got me doing some research. I found a series of articles from NASA.
He's so good at that.
A series of articles from NASA back in 2005 that estimate that maintaining all the lawns in the lower 48 states requires around 200 gallons of fresh water per person per day. Considering there's 12,000 people in Tomball, you can see how water supplies got tight. Lawns made up of grasses and plants that are native to the ecosystem they're in, however, would require a lot less water to maintain. So I would suggest that Tomball consider an ordinance requiring new build property to plant native grasses and plants instead of the usual pretty grasses. As a side note, also from NASA, leaving grass clippings in your yard can help fight global warming. Decomposing clippings do release a little bit of carbon, but they release way more nitrogen, which kicks your lawn into photosynthesis overdrive, and that captures a whole lot more carbon than the clippings release. Across the U.S., that could mean up to 37 billion pounds of carbon per year pulled straight out of the atmosphere. Something to think about.
I think you make some great points. In the arid Southwest, Arizona, New Mexico, Southern California, even, I think, they're actually encouraging not only native plants like various cactuses and brush plants, but also landscaping with rock.
Yes.
So, you know, we had a drought in the Houston area 10 or 12 years ago, and I remember very clearly that I was sorely tempted to go that route. I could not put enough water on the ground to keep things alive. Now, as far as your point, when you hear those loud blowers, gardeners' blowers early in the morning, it's usually yard people blowing dirt and grass clippings from the street back onto the lawn. So there's that.
That's true. Although on my street particularly, I do see a few, more than a few bags of transparent bags of grass clippings every week. So, you know, not everybody does it.
Well, I mean, that's how they clean up. However, they may have bagged mowers. So that may be how they get that. I don't know. I'm speculating. You know, a guess is like, no, I'm not going to say it. anyway, I do remember for decades, going back at least to the 80s, hearing about the long-term benefits to the lawn and the environment of so-called mulching mowers that deposit finely cut. They don't have bags on the back. They deposit finely cut clippings back onto the grass in the yard. There are really only two practical downsides to these mowers. One is that the cut grass clippings are not all that small. And two, over time, your ground level rises, which makes sense, right? Because you're putting plant matter on the lawn that, if it properly decomposes, becomes like part of the soil. And then your grass grows on top of it. And now it's higher.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah.
So the only practical downsides are that, and that over time your ground level rises, and that creates problems when, like, lawn edges are rising above your curbs, above your walks, above your driveways. It starts to create funny issues. It also creates the need occasionally for what's called dethatching periodically, which is when you have to pull up all the different runners that St. Augustine grass puts out because of all the clippings that it's growing on top of, and it's almost like grass with a toupee on it.
Oh yeah, okay.
So you sometimes have to dethatch, because the alternative to dethatching is just this incredibly dense rising lawn.
Yeah,
it's an interesting thing. I mean, absolutely there are advantages to it, but, you know, as Rosanna Dana used to say, it's always something. I do have some references there if you want to look at them. Most of them were found by Andrew. You've got your ecological impact of lawns, more lawns than irrigated corn, looking for lawns, all from a NASA study. And a little bit of trivia. Did you know that in 1907, the community of Peck was renamed Tomball for local congressman at the time, Thomas Henry Ball, who had a major role in the development of the Port of Houston.
Okay.
Now, Andrew, in our pre-show conversations, you know, we're like, well, how did they get Tom Ball? Why isn't it two words like Sugarland?
Yeah, I mean,
why isn't it just Ball?
Yeah, that's what I would have named it, because it's named after somebody. You take it from their last name. And then I thought about it a little bit more, and that would mean going from Peck to Ball.
Yeah.
So which is a little bit phallic for maybe some people's taste in Tom.
It would have been a questionable taste in a dainty era.
Mm.
Maybe which, that's why, by the way, had the reputation for being much more dainty than it actually was. It was actually a bawdy era that pretended to be dainty.
Aren't we all?
Yeah, well, if we're lucky. Okay, next one is from communityimpact.com. Harris County's new burn ban could last until October. A burn ban is now in effect for at least the next 3 months in unincorporated Harris County, in other words, not within any city limits, after commissioners approved the measure at an August 8th meeting, citing extreme temperatures and continuous dry conditions. Harris County joins more than 160 other Texas counties that have already implemented a burn ban, and they include Galveston, Waller, Chambers, Liberty, and Montgomery counties. Fire Marshal Lori Christensen said in a news release that excessive heat conditions and a lack of rain have elevated various environmental levels that could cause potential forest fires. Harris County residents will have to abide by the following guidelines and are advised to report any unattended fires to 911. It's an emergency. If you see an open fire, 911 if it's unattended. And that's according to Public Information Officer Brandy Dumas. Dumas said, let's make smart decisions during this ban because we are experiencing very dry conditions. In short, we don't want to be Western Canada. So what you're allowed, approved ceremonial fires. I don't think that takes explaining. Non-commercial cooking, such as backyard cookouts and barbecues, of course, exercise reasonable care. Any welding performed under county fire code requirements is allowed. Sales or use of fireworks is allowed, but the department discourages using it altogether during the ban because a spark, you know, just an ember. Now, what you cannot do, no outdoor open burning except in outdoor burning activities that are authorized by the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. Those actions found in violation of the burn ban will be considered a Class C misdemeanor punishable by a fine of up to $500. Plus, of course, whatever damage your fire does to something else. The Harris County Fire Marshal's Office shared the following tips for residents to keep in mind during the ban. Store gasoline in an approved safety can away from occupied buildings. I will tell you already, that becomes tricky if you have an attached garage. So, you know, start to think about options. All combustibles, such as firewood, wood picnic tables, boats, and stacked lumber, should be kept away from structures. Also, clear the roof surfaces and gutters regularly to avoid the buildup of flammable materials, such as leaves and other debris. In rural areas, clear a fuel break or fire break at least 3 times the fuel length around all structures. Zooming out on this topic, as of August 8th, Harris County's average drought scale is 681. According to county officials, conditions between 600 and 800 have the potential to lead to intense, prolonged fires. Andrew?
Mm. Well, you know, reading this article, there's one thing I've never understood. I've never understood why people have to be told not to burn things. Now, ceremonial fires, I get. I'm not talking about them. And I understand that not everybody has municipal trash pickup. But surely there have to be other methods of waste disposal that don't risk smoke inhalation, self-immolation, or burning your house down. Am I missing something?
Well, if you've ever spent a lot of time out in the country, you will often see burn cans or sometimes burn piles. You know, trash pickup out in the rural areas, it's rare or it's expensive. Like, you have to get a dumpster and then you have to pay them to take the dumpster. So they often burn things like scrap wood, grass, brush, and other stuff in a ventilated metal barrel so the fire gets oxygen. Those fires send up sparks. Without burning, folks can end up with massive piles of debris over a time, which at some point will have to be dealt with. I think those people are the main target of the burn ban order. Then you have the fire bugs, people who just like to burn stuff, and of course no county burn ban will get through to those folks. Okay, you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston at 90.1 FM HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central and re-airing Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear the show live online from anywhere in the world at kpft.org Or you can get Google Podcasts, which you can download from both the Android or iPhone app stores, and you can listen to all the shows anytime you want, or by visiting archive.kpft.org for previous episodes of this show and about 100 other KPFT programs. We usually heavily excerpt every story, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Click the Show Posts and More tab at the top of the webpage, find the post for the show or show date you're looking for. I use search words all the time. It's the only way I can get through, like, 1,000 shows. And the most recent shows are closest to the top. Shows and articles go back to May 2010, so you can also type in the keywords. Shows now are about 80% scripted, so if there is a topic that interests you, usually you can scan the episode's text if there is one particular topic that you would like more information on. Plus, of course, you've got the links to the articles themselves. We're on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. You can check our Facebook page at ThinkWing Radio with Mike Honig and look for me on Threads and Twitter at ThinkWing Radio. Plus, Andrew has his own stuff.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on YouTube, where I play games, talk socialist politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and YouTube.
YouTube. Okay, next story from communityimpact.com. Texans can purchase school supplies and clothes tax-free this weekend. Yay! As families prepare for the 2023-24 school year, a variety of school supplies and clothing will be sold without sales tax from August 11th to 13th. Qualifying items worth under $100, which include backpacks, lunchboxes, uniforms, graduation gowns, fabric face masks, school supplies, and more, will be exempt from state and local sales tax. Purchases can be made in stores, online, by phone, or by mail. Shoppers will save cumulatively around $136 million in sales taxes this weekend, according to the Texas Comptroller. Texans who pay sales taxes on qualified items during the tax holiday can request a refund from the seller or fill out a form to which there is a link in what I've excerpted from the article or the article itself. Visit the Comptroller's website for a complete list of tax-exempt items. Again, link in the article. So, absolutely, take advantage of the sales tax holiday. But for me, this so-called sales tax holiday is another opportunity to remind listeners that Texas is effectively a flat tax state. That means there is no progressive taxation in Texas that I'm aware of. If you buy clothes, rich people pay the same tax you do, but it's a smaller fraction of their income. If you buy fuel or use electricity or natural gas, rich people pay the same fuel tax rate you do, but it's a smaller fraction of their income. If you buy a car, rich people pay the same sales tax rate that you do, but it's a smaller fraction of their income. If you own a $100,000 house, you pay the same property tax rate as people who own a $1 million house, but it's still a smaller fraction of their income. And, of course, my bete noire, toll roads are flat taxes that not only cost the rich a smaller fraction of their income than you, toll roads also discriminate against the poor, essentially making travel and commuting slower for many in the working classes by excluding them from the toll roads they can't afford. By the way, this also increases air pollution as slower traffic pollutes more. So by design, all Texas taxation punishes the poor and punishes them the more the poorer they are. So sales tax holidays, just a sop to the less than rich so they can feel like the state is cutting them a break. Well, the state is not cutting you a break. Cutting you a break would be lowering the flat sales tax rate all year round so that you don't have to chase around for sales tax exempt stuff. Cutting you a break would be the state mandating progressively higher property taxes on homes worth $1 million or more. Cutting you a break would be a progressive state income tax that would allow either more state and local services through revenue sharing or cutting other flat taxes that favor the rich and the well-off. So I guess I am the perennial Grinch of sales tax holidays. Bah, humbug, I say.
Well, the one good thing about sales tax holidays is getting to hear that speech again. Gather around the radio and hear Mike complain. It's tradition.
It's kind of like my personal version of a Christmas carol. Okay, our next story is from the Houston Chronicle. We're doing a lot of local on the show today. Just so much to choose from. It's hard, was hard to pick, but here we are. So from the Houston Chronicle, Houston considers first ever policy to regulate how to create and terminate TERSs. A 2022 Chronicle investigation found the zones often trap funds in stable or wealthy communities while needier areas stagnate. What is a TERS, you may ask? You will know shortly. Houston City Council is set to vote this week on the city's first ever policy governing how to create, grow, or disband economic development zones, which have sparked controversy for decades and now claim nearly $200 million in city revenue each year. These so-called tax increment reinvestment zones, T-I-R-Z, TERS, were the subject of a Houston Chronicle investigation last year, which found that the agencies often trap funds in stable or wealthy communities while needier areas stagnate. The investigation also found that despite Houston being the TERS capital of Texas, the city's only written rules regarding them were approved in 1990, and for decades had simply been waived each time the council formed a new zone. Mayor Sylvester Turner now is asking the city council members to amend the city's financial policies by adding guidelines for how Houston will use TERSs at Wednesday's meeting, which would be today. Property tax collections within a TERS's boundaries are frozen. As development occurs and property values rise, the additional tax revenue generated, known as the increment, is supposedly invested back into the zone to pay for public improvements and infrastructure in an effort to attract more development. Under the proposed policy, to start a new TERS, there must be a committed or known private investment already planned for the area in the zone's first year. These developments must be projected to raise property values in the zone by 50% before the TERS expires, typically within 30 years. And there must be a clear plan showing how the public projects will bring more private investment into the area. In the past, the city often drew large zones to include the commercial areas of entire neighborhoods under the assumption that growth would eventually come and generate revenue for new projects. I think that's, isn't that what they call trickle down? But that didn't always happen. And Gwendolyn Tillotson, deputy director of the mayor's Office of Economic Development, said, "These policies are intended to refine the process and to ensure that there are known investments or known funding opportunities," Tillotson went on. "We have to know that there's going to be private investment from any source coming into the area because that is the only way that increment is generated. This will likely lead to smaller TERSs, more focused on adding improvements around specific projects," said Tillotson and the chief development officer, Andy Icken. They pointed to a new TERS in the Texas Medical Center last December, which includes the site of a 37-acre life science campus known as TMC3. The idea of using tax increment financing to stimulate growth in underdeveloped neighborhoods has been widely adopted by cities across the U.S., said Kasia Tarchinska, a senior research analyst at Good Jobs First, a Washington, D.C.-based research and advocacy center focused on accountability and economic policies. Over time, however, many local governments have strayed from the original intention of revitalizing blighted areas, either loosely enforcing related rules or using the program simply as another financing tool allowing developers to reduce costs, Tarchinska said. Would that qualify as kind of a slush fund, Andrew? This, Tarchinska said, is why guidelines for these zones need to be specific and comprehensive. Houston's brief two-page framework, she said, remains vague and subject to interpretation. Under the proposed policy, a zone's lifespan would extend only if it helps fund approved projects or leverages new grants or donations. As for annexation zones, would be allowed to grow if the expansion matches the goals, helps draw private investment to the added section, or enables the use of government funds to create housing for low-income residents. Gwendolyn Tillotson of the Mayor's Office of Economic Development again said that the Turner administration's guiding principle in developing the new TERS policies was that a zone should be an impermanent catalyst for private investment by funding public projects in an area. This story from the Chronicle goes into a lot more detail, is worth reading, and I was not paywalled, so maybe you won't be either. And of course, there is a link. I think that the last time Andrew and I discussed TERSs was March 15th of 2021, and I have a link to that show. At that time, it was based on a community impact story about the Montrose TERS. We didn't really know anything about them. We did a lot of head scratching and research to figure out what they were and how they worked and who ran them and who was responsible for regulating them. And I think the answers we came up with were, respectively, not sure, not sure, not sure, and nobody. That may not have been far off the mark, as it turns out. If the rules regulating TERSs haven't been examined and rewritten in a third of a century, I'd say it's about frigging time. And I hope the Chronicle and Community Impact do follow-up stories on this. Okay, you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM HD2, Houston's Community Media, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central, re-airing Thursdays at 6 p.m. Central. You can also hear the show live online from anywhere in the world at kpft.org. I know we have international listeners. On Google Podcasts, which can be downloaded from either the Android or iPhone app stores, and it does work, or by visiting archive.kpft.org for previous episodes of this show and about 100 other KPFT programs. KPFT is Houston's community media broadcasting about 100 show titles. And to do that means we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied homegrown programming, which requires things like electricity and equipment. And you can show your support for Think Wing Radio and KPFT by going to kpft.org and hitting the donate button. All donations are tax deductible. Pick your favorite show, maybe this one, and the amount of your donation, large, small, or in between, or maybe a continuing donation, $5, $10, $15, $20 a month, you know, a couple of coffees a month, a couple of Starbucks, would be an enormous help because it gives us a steady stream of revenue. You may qualify also for a lovely thank you gift. Just ask and tell people about KPFT and your favorite shows, because spreading the word helps us too, and it's free. Okay, our next story is from thenewyorktimes.com. $30. The entrance fee to America's museums keeps rising. Their buildings have expanded, their expenses have surged, even as attendance slowed. Art lovers will bear the cost. The Guggenheim is the latest to increase its admission price to $30, which is becoming the new normal. Audience sizes just aren't what they used to be at the Guggenheim Museum, where membership, once a dependable source of income, has declined by nearly 16% since 2019, and attendance in June slumped by 26% from 89,000 to 66,000 over the same time frame. What has increased is the cost of running the institution. A newly unionized workforce has bumped up salary expenses, while inflation is driving up the cost of everything from heating to shipping artworks, according to senior museum officials. At the Guggenheim, leaders said that options for relief were limited after 3 years of managing the fiscal crisis of the pandemic. And so, on Tuesday, the museum raised admission fees, bringing the cost of an adult ticket from $25 to what is becoming the new normal for major museums, $30. Most cultural organizations are navigating the same uncertainties, asking if the decision to raise fees to offset operating costs, basically maximizing revenues from a smaller core of visitors and art lovers, is worth the risk of limiting access to great art to mostly wealthier patrons. Museums which are concerned about alienating the families and the diverse crowds they have been trying to court say it's typically a measure of last resort. Said Sarah Fox, a spokeswoman for the Guggenheim, "As we recover from the lingering financial strain caused by the pandemic, the museum needs to increase its admission prices, which have not been adjusted since 2015, said Sarah Fox. The new rates align with those of the museum community in New York City and will help support the operational costs of the museum. It's worth noting when the Guggenheim originally opened in 1959, the charge of admission was 50 cents, or about $5.20 today, which is kind of a far cry from $25 or $30. Museums, which often receive tax exemptions as nonprofits, are expected to keep their collections accessible to the general public, part of their mission. Some also receive subsidies. The Met received $26 million in government funding for the 2023 fiscal year on an annual budget of around $300 million, while the Guggenheim received $520,000 during the same period on a budget of $67.7 million. Pay-what-you-wish policies often come with limitations. The Met offers its Pay-what-you-wish program for residents of New York State and students in the tri-state area. The Guggenheim charges students $19, That's children under 12 get free admission. And the museum maintains a pay-as-you-go wish policy or pay-as-you-wish policy for everyone on Saturdays. And that is expanding by 1 hour from 5 to 8 p.m. So pay-as-you-wish for residents of New York from 5 to 8 p.m. The Whitney holds its pay-what-you-wish hours on Fridays from 7 to 10. These are hours when, yes, people are home from work, which is a good thing. Of course, you're not going to see the whole museum in one go, but at least you get to see it. Marcus A. Harshaw, a senior director of museum experience at the Carnegie Science Center in Pittsburgh, who also teaches museum studies at Johns Hopkins University, said that museums have limited options for an economic fix. Large donations from corporations and philanthropists often come with restrictions, what we sometimes call strings, that prevent officials from putting the money toward operating costs. Harshaw added that museum officials are always looking at the bell curve, because when the price goes up, attendance goes down. Raising ticket prices is so unpopular that many institutions have increased fees during periods of leadership transition in order to diffuse responsibility, several museum experts said. So finger-pointing never goes out of style. The article goes on along those lines of rising entrance fees and lower attendance, and there's a lot of discussion and rationalization and explanation. But, you know, the fact at the end of the day is higher. Now, to me, this really isn't just about the price of museum admission. It's that an educated electorate is a prerequisite for democracy. It's in the public interest for museums to be as affordable as possible and free when possible to allow the broadest possible educational opportunities to the most people possible. The cheapest tickets I could find for the August 11th Astros game was about $45. So the good news, surprised me, is that a day at the museum is still mostly cheaper than an Astros game. As one example, the Houston Museum of Science is currently, until at least August 13th, $25 per person for kids 12 and up, plus parking, plus food, maybe souvenirs. That's easily a day's pay for a low-wage worker with a family of four, assuming no one stays home. As a rule, free museum days tend to be around Thursdays in Houston. I guess that might be the day for school field trips. I'll tell you something funny. I think it's funny. Do you want to know what great world-class museums are free all the time? The Smithsonian Institution Museums and Zoo in Washington, D.C. Of course, you have to get to Washington, D.C., and it takes like a week to do justice to all the different buildings. But they're free. They're some of the best museums on the planet, and they're always free, and not even the British Museum is free, and it's in the same class, but much smaller. Those are your tax dollars at work. Wouldn't that be nice for major museums everywhere? Andrew?
I absolutely agree that museum prices should be as low as possible, and I think that government subsidies are the most obvious way to make that happen. We have enough money in federal budgets for all sorts of military projects that are obsolete by the time they come to fruition. Cut a few of those, or sell the outdated tech they produced for scrap, and put that money towards enriching people's minds. Maybe then the Houston Museum of Natural Science can stop hosting exhibits about the joys of oil extraction.
Oh, when I went to Epcot, mm-hmm. it was basically all an advertisement for like Epcot.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was really, really annoying. Yeah. Now, I have gone to the trouble... And just so you know, I always have tons of reference links for you folks. So if you ever want to go to thinkwingradio.com for any specific show, you might be amazed at the amount of work and the number of references that you can use as a starting point. Because we've done your work for you.
Yep.
So, for example, I went and looked up free Houston Museum District days and times. I learned that there are 10 museums that are always free. Asia Society Texas Center, Contemporary Arts Museum of Houston, Diverse Works, Houston Center for Contemporary Craft, the Houston Center for Photography, which could be fun, the Jung Center, Lawndale Art Center, the Menil Collection, which is actually pretty impressive. I've seen pieces of it. The Moody Center for the Arts and Rothko Chapel, which I admit I went to and didn't understand because it looked like white canvases. I'm sorry, it's white canvases. Then there are the specific free times that some museums have for general admission only. Also included in this list, and these all have links, the Asia Society Texas Center, because it's always free, including general admission. the Buffalo Soldiers National Museum, the Children's Museum of Houston in the Heights, the Czech Center, that's C-Z-E-C-H, not like money, the Czech Center Museum of Houston, the Health Museum, which I'm told is interesting, the Holocaust Museum in Houston, the Houston Museum of African American Culture, the Houston Museum of Natural Science, which has a link to the museum and a specific link to hours and pricing and free hours, etc., because they vary. The Houston Zoo does have free times. You can look them up. And also the Museum of Fine Arts Houston. Now, mostly it's around Thursdays, you know, when everybody's off. But, you know, if you can work around, it's an option. It's there. Yep. I wanted you to know it's there. Andrew, anything you want to add to that?
You know, I'm trying to think. I'm not sure I've ever actually been to the Houston Zoo. I should go to it sometime.
You should, before zoos are obsolete.
Yeah.
Okay, our next story is from the New York Times. Amid signs of a COVID uptick, researchers brace for the new normal. Infections remain very low despite signs of a slight increase. Now experts are looking for clues to what living with the coronavirus will be like this winter and beyond. And this is a relatively brief excerpt. Echoing patterns in prior years, coronavirus infections are slowly ticking up in parts of the country, the harbinger of a possible fall and winter wave. With the numbers, the numbers remain low for now, but are unlikely to reach the horrific highs seen in previous winters, experts said in interviews. Infections have been trending upward for about 4 weeks, according to data gathered from wastewater monitoring, test positivity rates and hospitalizations, and emergency room visits. Taken together, the figures offer researchers and public health officials the first glimpse of the coronavirus as a post-pandemic seasonal threat, what they call an endemic permanent fixture of the infectious disease landscape. Wastewater analysis points to the highest increases in the Northeast and the South, followed by the West and Midwest. After hitting a trough at the end of June, hospitalizations are inching upward again, but fortunately very slowly. Test positivity has risen to 7.6%, a level last seen in November of 2021. That's not good. And that summer, just before the Delta variant swept the nation. This is the fourth summer now that we see a wave beginning around July, often starting in the South, said Caitlin Rivers, an epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Nearly all Americans have built up multiple layers of immunity following repeated infections, immunizations, or both, so the virus is unlikely to cause the harm this winter that was seen in previous seasons. Still, for older adults, I resemble that remark, pregnant women and people with weakened immune systems or certain chronic conditions, the virus may yet pose a serious threat. The number of deaths is the lowest since the pandemic began, and roughly one-tenth of the levels in January. Most virus fatalities now occur in adults older than 75. Whew, got a break there. But the real toll will be apparent only at the end of the year after the fall and winter's respiratory blitz, experts say. And then I have a little supplement from CBSNews.com that the CDC says the COVID variant EG.5 is now dominant, including a strain some are calling Eris, for no reason that is discernible except it started in, you know, groups. The EG.5 variant now makes up the largest proportion of new COVID-19 infections nationwide, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimated, as multiple parts of the country have been reporting their first upticks of the virus in months. Remember, this is like getting the flu in August, so this is early. It is one of those several closely related Omicron subvariants that have been competing for dominance in recent months. All of these variants are descendants of the XBB strain, which this fall's COVID-19 vaccines will be redesigned to guard against. Dr. Maria Van Kerkhove, the World Health Organization's technical lead for COVID-19, said on July 26th, "While the emergency of COVID has been lifted and we are no longer in a crisis phase, the threat of COVID is not gone. So keeping up your surveillance and sequencing remains absolutely critical." So my only comment here is add COVID to your list of fall vaccines along with flu and whatever else you need to get. I have to get my second shingles shot. Trying to just keep up. Andrew?
You know, what gets me is that it never had to come to this. We could have mobilized as a society to stop the spread, and we just didn't. Or rather, our leaders decided our lives weren't worth the cost of business. The result is that hundreds of thousands are dead. Millions are still at risk, and we will likely never defeat this disease, merely learn to live with it. I hope we don't let people in power make the same callous choices next time.
And that was Andrew's version of my Christmas Carol rant.
Yeah, fair enough.
But you're right. I agree. And and just sort of as a reference, the NIH has picked a replacement for Mr. Fauci, Dr. Fauci, Jean Marazzo, infectious disease chief. I have a link to the story talking about her and what her qualifications are. Okay, our next story is from MotherJones.com. Low-income Puerto Ricans can get $450 million for rooftop solar, a federal lifeline for households vulnerable to the island's frequent blackouts. The Department of Energy announced last week that it will provide nearly $500 million to install rooftop solar and battery backup systems on the homes of some of Puerto Rico's most vulnerable residents. The funding could cover the installation of as many as 40,000 photovoltaic systems, providing a measure of energy security to an archipelago long burdened by frequent and prolonged blackouts. The program, which Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm outlined at an event in San Juan, is part of the $1 billion Puerto Rico Energy Resilience Fund that Congress approved last December. The fund is intended to provide reliable and affordable energy to the highest need households, many of whom endure power outages daily or weekly. After Hurricane Fiona left the entire archipelago without power last September, President Biden put the Department of Energy in charge of a multi-agency effort to overhaul the U.S. territory's energy system, which is in despair and depends, disrepair rather, but I imagine that's in despair, and depends upon fossil fuels to generate 97% of its electricity, all of which, of course, has to be shipped in. Puerto Rico's goal of achieving a zero-emission grid by 2050, streamlining approval processes, and deploying the billions of dollars allocated for Hurricane Maria recovery that have not yet been spent. The effort will take years, and in the meantime, Puerto Ricans suffer from the persistent anxiety of not knowing when the power will go out next. They're a little like Texans. In the last year, the number of rolling blackouts there exceeded the North American utility standard by 570 times, according to the DOE. The $450 million that Granholm announced will be directed toward lowest income households. It will be reserved for people who are medically vulnerable and depend on plug-in medical equipment and those who live in so-called last mile communities, most located deep in the main island's central mountain ranges. After Hurricane Maria, some of these municipalities lacked power for nearly a year. The focus on very low-income families will supplement an already robust solar industry in Puerto Rico. Photovoltaic panel and battery installations skyrocketed after Hurricane Maria, and some 3,000 installations are done monthly now. More than 85,000 households have photovoltaic systems, but the poorest households have not been able to participate in the transition, according to P.J. Wilson, president of the Solar and Energy Storage Association in Puerto Rico, and those folks are burdened by electricity prices at least 50% higher than the national average. Most of the money will go directly to solar installation companies, nonprofit energy providers, and electric cooperatives that will install, own, and maintain the systems, essentially a lease arrangement. An innovative $3.5 million solar ambassador program will determine which households receive them. The ambassadors will go into communities and identify households most in need, a stark contrast from other widely criticized first-come, first-served programs in Puerto Rico. Another notable aspect of the program is its third-party ownership model, which takes the onus off households to maintain the systems. Installers must manage and maintain them for at least 20 years and replace worn-out batteries, and the program allocates consumer protection funding to hold solar companies accountable. Installers will cover just 5% of the cost, making it easier for nonprofit energy providers and small cooperatives to participate. The program structure was in large part shaped by the vigorous participation of the community outreach program led by Granholm. In the last year, she has been to Puerto Rico 5 times to gather input from Puerto Ricans at town halls and roundtables. A spring visit to the home of a couple in the mountain town of Orocovis, where their son relied on a ventilator to breathe and a small diesel generator was the family's only lifeline in a blackout, underscored the urgency of the problem, Granholm told Grist in March. It's life or death, she said. The department incorporated public concerns about paying for repairs, prioritizing those most in need, working with existing community networks, and ensuring equitable access to information about the program and the ability to apply. Such an approach represents a seismic shift compared to what Puerto Ricans have experienced from local and federal governments, especially in the time after Hurricane Maria caused $90 billion in damage and claimed more than 4,000 lives, according to Charlotte Gossett Navarro of the Hispanic Federation. That was, of course, the Trump years. A second tranche of the $1 billion Puerto Rican Energy Resilience Fund, the details of which will be announced in the coming months, will support energy solutions for multifamily residences. The accelerated timeline underscores the dire need for reliable, affordable power in Puerto Rico. Heat indices in parts of the archipelago have reached 125 degrees this summer. That's always, by the way, in a well-ventilated space in the shade. And hurricane season is just weeks away. Granholm said Monday that every agency moving Puerto Rico toward a resilient and clean energy future must work as quickly as possible. Granholm said our hair should be on fire. Andrew?
My first instinct was that this program is damage control, objectively helpful to keep some people alive, but not solving any underlying problems. Seeing that this is just one part of a larger policy to upgrade the Puerto Rican grid does give me hope that the larger policy can become more than just damage control. But considering the U.S. government's track record with austerity in Puerto Rico, I'm not going to hold my breath. Many other U.S.-imposed austerity-related problems will still exist on the island after this. If Washington can't bear to let go of its little Caribbean fiefdom, the least it should do is take care of the people there, regardless of how uncapitalist that may be. I would like to see this program be the start of a shift in that direction.
Unfortunately, the stuff that the Trump regime screwed up or ignored can't be fixed overnight. Sometimes not at all. People of Puerto Rico have waited far too long for this kind of U.S. aid, but at least it's now in the pipeline. I agree that if the U.S. wants to keep Puerto Rico as a possession, we should care about the people there. We may be seen by some as an empire. We may even be indifferent imperialists, but I hope and believe we are not simply extractive imperialists. Especially for islands like Puerto Rico, decentralized solar power should be an enormous help after hurricanes and save a lot of money over importing liquefied natural gas and diesel fuel, etc. Not every solar system will survive a storm on every house, but at least losing central power won't be as much of an issue, and neighbors can help each other where solar survives a storm. In the next story, I'll be discussing more about my experience with solar. And we also have some references about financial oversight of Puerto Rico and pronouncing the word tranche versus tranche. It actually ends up being quite an interesting question. Okay, our next story.
Coming up right after this.
is coming up right after this. And it's solar power to the rescue as Europe's energy system weathers extreme heat. You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central and again Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear the show live online from anywhere in the world at kpft.org by downloading it with Google Podcasts, my suggestion, available from the Android or iPhone app stores, or by visiting archive.kpft.org for previous versions of this show and about 100 other programs. We usually heavily excerpt every story on the show, which is why we include links to the full articles on Show Posts and More page at thinkwingradio.com. You can also visit kpft.org to find out what's new at the station, catch up with your favorite shows on the archive, and help keep the lights on by clicking the donate button. You can also donate by calling KPFT at 713-526-5738, extension 1. That's 713-526-5738, extension 1. Remember, our shows now are mostly scripted, so you can actually search for specific information without having to listen through a whole recording. You can also send us your thoughts about our show by emailing thinkwingradio@msn.com. We're on Facebook at Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig, which I've been trying to add more content to. And I am on Twitter and Threads at Think Wing Radio. Plus, Andrew has his own accounts.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on YouTube, where I play games, talk socialist politics, and make stupid jokes. That's Dominate, EYE, on Twitter, Tumblr, and YouTube.
Okay, our next story, solar power to the rescue as Europe's energy system weathers extreme heat. A major increase in solar power generation in southern Europe played a leading role in averting energy shortages during the heat waves of recent weeks when temperatures broke records and drove unprecedented demand for air conditioning. Solar power is particularly suited to coping with summer heat as the sun's radiation is strongest around the hottest part of the day, and of course the days are longer when electricity demand for cooling is also at its highest. The very significant growth in solar basically compensates for the peaks that are caused by air conditioning, said Christian Ruby, Secretary General of Electricity Industry Group Eurelectric, said of the situation in Spain. Spain and Greece are among the countries that have installed many more solar panels in the face of record high energy prices last year and the quest for increased energy security linked to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Data showed that solar provided almost 24% of Spain's electricity in July this year, up from 16% in July of 22. When soaring temperatures and demand for cooling led to a peak in Sicilian power demand on July 24th, nearly half of the excess demand, which totaled 1.3 gigawatts, was covered by solar, Refinitiv data show. Sicily's solar production last month was more than double that of July 2022. Without the additional solar, the system stability impact would have turned out much worse, Refinitiv power analyst Natalie Girl said. Higher solar output helped to justify demand in Italy and Greece, satisfy demand rather, in Italy and Greece. During Greece's peak power demand this year, also on July 24th, solar photovoltaics covered 3.5 gigawatts of the total 10.35 gigawatt demand, about a third, said grid operator IPTO. Even in cooler and less sunny Western countries such as Belgium, solar energy has covered more than 100% of the extra energy needed during midday spikes in power demand. Analysts say a second factor has helped to keep Europe's systems running this summer. Overall power demand has been relatively low. That has been the case since Europe's energy crisis last year when Russia cut gas deliveries to Europe. Energy prices in Europe are still high compared with historic levels, and consumers and industries have responded by using less power. Overall demand has been below normal. Italy's average hourly power use in July was 4.4% lower than a year previously, while Spain's was down by 3.6%, Refinitiv data show. I will note that this is a process known as demand destruction due to price elasticity, which is all a fancy way of saying that higher prices change consumers' behavior. Going on with the story, even before this year's wildfires and record temperatures, heat and drought last year reduced hydropower generation, used to be considered endless, hampered fuel transport by river, and forced some nuclear power plants to curtail output when cooling of the plants was limited by high river temperatures. In a letter to the European Commission last week, industry groups, including Solar Power Europe, urged policymakers to speed up investments in energy grids and promote projects that couple solar with energy storage to ensure that solar power expands quickly enough to meet climate change goals. So in the interest of keeping listeners up to date in my personal experience with solar, one of the things I found interesting about this story is that it kind of perfectly reflects my experience with solar power on my house. July showed the highest power generation for the past 12 months, but covered only about a third of my power consumption because of the air conditioning. And this kind of tracks with the European sample. In the winter months, from November to February, I had the least solar generation, but I was using gas heat. So between daytime power and nighttime batteries, I was actually getting about 50 to 60% of my power from solar. If I had an electric furnace or a heat pump, my electric use would likely have been higher, but I don't know. This also tracks the European example in this story. In a summer power outage, I could turn my AC up to 80 or 85 degrees, and that would be uncomfortable, but my power would last longer, and it's better than the house going to the outdoor ambient temperature. And this meets my main original goal of energy security, not having a 24-hour period to go by without electricity. Andrew?
What's interesting to me here is the offhand mention in the article that people generally have been using less power because energy prices have risen. To me, that supports the possibility of degrowth, reducing production and consumption and making the most efficient use of existing production for the benefit of people and the environment. If people can manage to use less energy to help save money, surely they can use less energy to help save the Earth. All it takes is the right culture and the right incentives.
Well, don't overlook energy efficiency improvements. You know, I used to sell appliances, and one glaring example is ovens. Ovens used to put out massive amounts of heat into the kitchen while cooking food. Their insulation now has gotten so good that the outsides of the ovens are cooler while the walls have gotten thinner, which has also translated into larger ovens within the same kitchen space. Literally like getting 5 pounds of potatoes in a 4-pound bag. These thinner, better insulated walls also mean more heat to the food, less heat to the kitchen, less air conditioning necessary to stay cool, and less energy being used overall. And, you know, this goes to light bulbs also. You have compact fluorescents and you have LED lights, and they put out a tiny fraction of the heat, that waste heat that incandescents do. In my lifetime, car miles per gallon has doubled and tripled. My minivan gets about twice the miles per gallon as my dad's 1969 Chevy Bel Air, with about the same power in a V6 that he got in a V8. Energy efficiency has made enormous strides in the last 50 years, in spite of people with the mindset of Ronald Reagan, who tore Jimmy Carter's solar panels off the White House roof out of sheer spite. Those folks are still around and must be opposed, and as Ohioans are saying today, elections have consequences. They can even be good consequences. I unfortunately don't think we have time for the last story, do we?
Yeah, I think so. I think we got to end it here.
Oh, well, I told you we had so much to choose from. It was just an embarrassment of textual riches. Well, I can include it in the post if you want to go read the blog post, but we'll try to cover it next week.
Yeah, who knows? We might get to it next week. So
yeah, we might force ourselves to get to it next week because... You know, nothing's getting any fresher. Anyway, you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Houston's community media, KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM, HD2. My co-host, indispensable editor and co-producer is Andrew Ferguson. We hope you've enjoyed the show and found it interesting and look forward to sharing this time with you again next week. You all take care.
See you later.
Let's keep on looking for the light. Can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside the storm. Why don't we cross the bridge together and find the place that's safe and warm? It's not too late.
KPFT Artist Profile, Lena Bell.
Hey everybody, this is Glenna Bell. I'm here at the KPFT Studios, beautiful brand new building here on Caroline. So excited to be here. So I've been asked to talk just for a second about what I love about KPFT. Not only that they play my music, but I'm a listener. I listen to KPFT every day. And there are just so many great shows from the past that I've always enjoyed, and a bunch of new shows that are coming out for the future. So I hope everybody will tune in and continue to tune in and support our local community radio, because it's true, there really is nothing else like it. This is only in Houston. KPFT 90.1 FM.